Now, today's class is going to be exclusively, just about exclusively, based on an essay from one book before, as we complete the story of Abraham. This book, which I've made reference to before a year or two ago, is called Lo Kach Katuv B'Tanach. It's not written this way in the Bible. It's written by Yair Zakovitz and Avigdor Shinan, who are two scholars of Bible from Hebrew University. And what they try to do, which is a fascinating thing, is to understand the traditions behind the Bible that are not spoken. In other words, why does the Bible hint at this, but then you don't get the story about it? And I happened to be looking through it the other day, just randomly, and I came across the following, I have to find out now where, Ma'ira ben Rivka le'eved Avraham b'darkam mecharan. What happened between Rivka and Abraham's servant on the trip from Haran to Isaac? Because if you remember last week, we said, maybe she was interested in the servant, she's so nice to the servant. And then when we don't hear anything about the trip. So when I saw that, I thought, this is worth reading. And in fact, it turned out to be fascinating. Now, there are parts of the essay that actually aren't so germane to us. But there is one central piece of the essay which clearly suggests what they call erotic happenings. But that doesn't mean that something happened. It means that there is clear suggestions in the Torah to the reader, if you pay attention a certain way, that was a possibility, that was known. You'll see what I mean in a minute. So what I did was I went through the essay and I marked off the passages in the Tanakh that are important. And I'll tell you why I say that. And then also there was one passage from, I also looked in something to see if Yeshayahu Leibovitz had anything about this. And he had something really wonderful, but it wasn't exactly about this, but I want to share that with you too. It's about this subject, but, oh, right. He has a great question about why it is, he brings a question from the Meshech Chochmah, why it is, which is something that we didn't ask, why does Abraham say to the servant, Isaac is not allowed to marry someone from Midian, and he doesn't say it to Isaac, from Canaan, rather, and he doesn't just say to Isaac, by the way, I don't want you to marry someone from Canaan. And there's a beautiful answer in here, but I'm going to save it for later because it's more like a sermon. So first, let's go to the stuff that's not sermonic, which is what happened between Rebecca and the servant, which is something I don't think I'd ever give a sermon about. Okay, so remember, just to refresh your minds about the story, the servant goes to the well. He says, please, God, give me a sign if I say, please give me some water. And the woman says, here's water, and I'll also water your camels. Then she's the one who's been chosen. It's sure enough, Rebecca does more than that. They go back to Lavan's house, and there she leaves almost immediately, and they spend several days on the road, and then immediately she sees Isaac, dismounts from her camel, puts the veil over her face, and they're married. All right, but there's no comment about what happens between between Rivka and Eliezer or the servant until now. All right, so he says what happened, and then he points out that the trip isn't mentioned at all, despite the fact that there's a very explicit discussion of what happens between Rebecca and Isaac. So why is it that the trip isn't mentioned and the discussion is with Rebecca and Isaac? They look then at, first of all, the fact that there is a midrash. Now, I'm going to tell you the midrash. It's going to strike you as very strange. I just want to put that out there at the beginning. So you're going to have to wait for a long time to explain why the midrash isn't quite as strange as it seems. The midrash is that Rebecca, in fact, in falling from her camel, lost her virginity, but by accident, not by intercourse, and that Isaac at first did not believe her, And then, this is a midrash. Remember, this is not in the Torah. This is a rabbinic story about the Torah. Isaac at first did not believe her, and then they found the bloody stick that proved that it had penetrated her hymen, and therefore she was not a virgin. So that's the impetus for this essay. He says, where do you get such a bizarre story, despite the fact that, by the way, the bloody stick, you have to understand, is a Talmudic motif. The bloody stick is a Talmudic motif for a woman who lost her virginity through some kind of accident or something other than intercourse, okay? That's called being, it's literally called being penetrated by a stick. In other words, the idea is this woman didn't have intercourse and so shouldn't be viewed as not a virgin, but the fact is that she doesn't have, she's not intacto, right? She doesn't have a hymen. So why do they say that about Rebecca? And here we go. All right, first of all, what's Rebecca's name, father's name? Do you remember? That's her brother. She has a father. What's his name? Bituel. How do you say virgin? Bitula. Okay, so already there's something strange about the fact that Rebecca's father's name suggests the idea of virginity. Okay, Bituel, Bitula. Now, what you have to remember is, and this is hard to recapture, so let me see if I can think of an analogy to recapture it. If I said to you, I'm trying to think of a phrase that everybody knows. What's a common phrase that everyone knows? And if I start it, you would end it. A cliche. Next year. Okay. Well, you see, something like a rolling stone or a watch pot, not everyone knows. Those are cliches, but not everybody actually knows them. In this crowd, I would say next year in? Jerusalem. Fine. So, if I now write a book that says, and at the end they said next year, you would all know what they meant, right? Mm-hmm. 1,000 years from now, they might not. Remember that the rabbis lived in the Bible. When you use any word in the Bible, it automatically triggers in their minds other words. So when I take this trip around the Bible, or I say Bituel reminds them of Bitula, because it doesn't remind you, doesn't mean it wouldn't remind them. That association would be immediate. You can't say Bituel without thinking Bitula. It's too similar. It's like if I said, and her father's name was Virgie. Right? And you would think, well, obviously, right? There's some suggestion. If a writer writes a story and says, this girl whose father's name was Virgie, you're going to think of it right away. So, first of all, the Midrashist who knows the Bible intimately and every word suggests another word thinks Bituel, Bitula. Okay? That's the beginning. What's that? Bitula means virgin. Bituel means, I don't know, El is God. Bitu, I don't know what that would mean. Bat, maybe it's like daughter of God. It might come from daughter of God. I don't know. What's that? Verbally, just verbally, the way it sounds. Okay, but there's more. Believe me, there's much more. It does seem that way. Okay, the other thing is, it says explicitly in our story, she was a virgin, no man had known her, right? Remember that? So it calls attention to her virginity explicitly. There is only one other time that the phrase, there's a virgin, no man had known her, is used. And conveniently, I have it marked in my little Bible here. The one other time is in the book of Judges. When, as you may, I don't know if you remember this, by the way, it also recalls the story later of Lot and Sodom, where he says, my daughters are virgins. But the express phrase here is, Hine biti habetula upilak shehu otziyah v'adatam v'anu, and so on, v'lotev b'enechem v'ish lo ta'asu davar hanavela hazot. Here, the owner of my house said to them, please, my friends, don't commit a wrong. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out to you. That's in the book of Judges. And guess what happens to the daughter in the book of Judges? Obviously, saying my daughter is a virgin in the Bible is a prelude to her not being. Okay? We have two stories about that. Remember? Lot's daughters, before he says, here, take them, and the story in the book of Judges. So first of all, why are they saying my daughter? I mean, you don't say someone's a virgin unless there's some reason to assume they're not. Okay? That's one. Then we go on to verse 2. Doesn't seem that way. In fact, it seems the opposite. Now, what's the story here? What's that? It's Judges 16. But now I'm going to go to Samuel 13. Samuel 13. This happened sometimes afterward. Avshalom, son of David, had a beautiful sister named Tamar, and Amnon, son of David, became infatuated with her. Amnon was distraught because of his half-sister Tamar that he became sick, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for Amnon to do anything to her. What does Amnon do? He rapes her. Okay? So the prelude of saying that someone is a virgin in the Bible now has two echoes to the person who's reading this story of later violations. All right? Third, let's go to, where are we? Now we go to Judges chapter 4. Okay. Where are we? What does Eliezer ask her for when he first meets her? Judges chapter 4. Sisera, meanwhile, had fled on foot to the tent of Yael, wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was a friendship. Yael came out to greet Sisera and said to him, "Come in, my lord, do not be afraid." He entered her tent. She covered him with a blanket. He said to her, "Please let me have some water. I am thirsty." Do you remember what happens? What does Yael do to Sisera? He kills her. But before he kills her, he goes into her tent and she gives him milk and he falls asleep. Now, what are all the traditions about what happened before, in fact, he fell asleep? How did she get him to fall asleep and lower his guard? Wine is part of it. But it's not all of it. You can assume, right? The assumption is that they had intercourse. And then, after he fell asleep afterwards, she killed him, right? Which made her a hero in Israel, despite the obvious, you know, questionable other... but this is the sort of Mata Hari story, right, of the Bible. So the idea is, when you read in the Bible, if you know the Bible perfectly, a person saying to a woman, "Give me water," what other story is going to come to your mind? It's a verbal echo of the story of Yael and Sisera. So now you have several stories that remind you of that idea. And in fact, I mean, I'll give you another one. Do you remember where Isaac is when Rivka comes to see him? In the field. Right? Lasuach basadeh. Isaac is in the field. Okay? What else happens in a field that involves all of this? Does anyone know from the book of Devarim, of Deuteronomy? If a woman is in a field and cries rape, she is believed. Because if you're in a field and you cry out, no one will hear you. Right? The question is when she's in a city and cries out, where there are other people around and they would hear her cries. But if a woman is in a field and cries out, no one will hear her, and therefore she claims she was raped in the field, the presumption is to believe her because no one would have heard her even if she cried out. So even the mention of field is going to, with all these other verbal echoes, and so the question is, what happened to Rivka with Eliezer along the way? But I'm not quite done. What does he give her? That's right. Here's from the book of Ezekiel. "I clothed you with embroidered garments and gave you sandals of leather to wear and wound fine linen. I decked you out with finery and put bracelets on your arms, a chain around your neck, a ring in your nose. You adorned yourself with gold and silver. Your beauty won you fame among the nations." And what do they go out and do? not confident in, but confident in your beauty and fame, you played the harlot, you lavished your favors on every passerby. So, rings on the nose, that's from the book of Ezekiel talking to the people Israel. But then, it's not just there. One second. Again in Ezekiel, a few chapters later, it says, and the noise of the carefree multitude was there, of men drunk from the desert. They put bracelets on their arms and crowns in their head and say, let us go to destruction with adultery. And just one more, in case that was not enough for you. This from a different prophet, this time from Hosea. And do any of you know the story of Hosea? Fascinating story. Hosea marries a woman who becomes a prostitute, marries her again. Anyway, it's a long story. But, well, it's not that long, but it's an interesting one.
He was a prophet?
Yes, he was a prophet. The story of Hosea is a psychoanalyst dream. You should read the story of Hosea. Thus I will punish her for the days of the Baalim. Baalim are false gods, on which she brought them offerings when decked with earrings and jewels, and the same thing, nizma, the exact same word. She would go after her lovers, forgetting me, declares the Lord. So you have an extraordinary collection, and there are several others. There's another one that I will mention too. The other thing which is interesting is that in mythology, they point out, and they give many examples, twins are associated with adultery because they're assumed to have different fathers. Jacob and Esau are associated with adultery, for example, because why don't they look anything alike? Right? Why is that? That Jacob, right, is smooth and small and Esau is hairy and large, and that motif of twins coming from different fathers is apparently a long mythological motif. And so remember that Rivka has twins who are unlike each other. So all of this together, which you would never know if you didn't look for the other verbal echoes in the Bible, is this suggestion that something happens with Rivka and Isaac. And one of the ways, and Eliezer, and one, well, something does happen, I hope, with Rivka and Isaac too, but this is about Rivka and Eliezer. And one of the ways that the Midrash handles it is by saying that Isaac had that suspicion too, that he didn't miss all the things that we saw. In fact, he was aware of it, but he checked it all out and it was nothing, right? So that's what's probably behind that very strange Midrash, is anybody who reads this story and knows all the echoes says the Torah is telling us something, that there is a suspicion here. So Isaac must have had that suspicion too, because Isaac knew the Torah obviously as well as the people who read it later in the rabbinic mind, even though, you know, they always assume that the people know the Torah even when it comes after them, right? So Isaac, knowing the Torah, is going to wonder what happens, but he checks it out and in fact it proves to be nothing, even though there's a suspicion along the way. Okay? So that's, yes?
How could he check all of these signs?
According to the Midrash, miraculously the stick was preserved. Okay? But you, yes?
But Rivka became pregnant several years after.
Well, yes, I agree with you. It can't be. Although in the Torah, chronology doesn't matter. When they want to put something later or something earlier, they do it all the time. So they still want to eliminate that possibility. And remember, Eliezer didn't go away. Eliezer's still around the house, presumably. So if they started a relationship, who knows? It wouldn't be the first time, right, that somebody, I mean, look, Hagar was around the house too. And when the time came, Abraham and Hagar were together. And maybe again. We'll see when we come to the end of the chapter.
It makes sense, because in the back of my mind, I would say, what makes a strong woman like Rivka tolerate a passive guy like Isaac? So maybe throughout, Eliezer was the motivation for her or the drive for her to stay in that.
Okay, although I must say, I don't know about you, but I certainly have met couples where one is passive and the other is not. And often it's been the woman who's much more active than the man, and the man is very passive. So you never know. In fact, it might be that a woman in the ancient world who really wants to make her way would prefer a passive man, so that he doesn't control her. I don't know. Yeah.
It seems to be unlikely, given Eliezer's age, experience, and respect for his own position, that anything would happen. And secondly, it seems that the point of your sharing all this is that the density of illusion.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm glad you said that so that nobody misunderstands. I don't think for a second anything happened, and neither did any of the rabbis. The whole point of this, and the reason that I bring it up is exactly what Ada just said, it's not to suggest that anything happened, or that the rabbis thought that anything happened, or even that the Midrash was accepted, even that they thought, in fact, that this bizarre happening occurred where she lost her virginity. It's to show you that every time the rabbis read the Bible, they don't only read the verse in front of them. They read the whole Bible at once. And what took us, a half an hour to excavate would occur to them automatically. Just like if I said to you next year in, I don't have to spell it all out because it occurs to you automatically. So one of the joys of reading the book is that they spend the time to go through the entire Bible and to find those clues and to bring them to the reader's attention so that what they're saying is what the rabbis would have thought of right away. But for us, it requires a great deal of work. So when the Midrash talks to us, the Midrash is never talking to us just about what we see. Yeah. Well, there is that law of yichud, of being alone. I'll give you an example of that, by the way, in a minute. You're not allowed to be alone in a room with a woman, according to strict Jewish law, for exactly either because people could think bad things or because, in fact, bad things could happen, right, from the point of view of Jewish law. When I published my first book, the publicist that was hired by the publisher was a Hasidic woman. And she was a wonderful person and did a great job and is still a publicist, although I don't know I don't know if she's still as Hasidic as she was. But she spent a lot of time working in the Jewish world. And so I think a lot of influences played into that, but nonetheless. At the time, she was very seriously Hasidic, and so was her husband, and so were their kids. And I had a speech in New York and then in Philadelphia, and from Philadelphia I had a speech in Baltimore. And she called her husband to ask if she could drive with me from Philadelphia to Baltimore because it was Yichud, because we were going to be alone in a car, right? So he said yes, because he wasn't, he said, first of all, because no one would think, and also because it's a car and it has windows and it's not the same as Yichud, you're not alone in a closed room, and he didn't have a problem with it. But that question was a real question, because we're going to be alone in an enclosed space, a man and a woman, both of them married, and the law is that you're not supposed to do that. So you could give this example, but you can give many others. From.
Isn't there also part of it where if the door's open or if there's a third person that has a key?
Yeah, there are a lot of elaborations on the law. I mean, it depends how close someone else is to the room. Whether it's isolated, all those kinds of things, but the idea still remains that you're not supposed to be. Yeah.
I have a technical question. How come a prophet can marry a prostitute, but a Kohen cannot marry a...
Well, prophet doesn't have the same status as a Kohen. That has to do with ritual purity. And you have to be prepared ritually for the temple, but a prophet doesn't. And by the way, Hosea is unique in this, right? He's the only one that does it, yeah. Well, this is the glory of the Midrash. I mean, the Midrash invents things that have, and these are the rabbis, that have very little, they stand on very slim, grounding when you look at the Torah. But I would say this, if you assume that everything in the Torah is deliberate, then it doesn't use the word nezem for adultery in one place and use it in another place and think you're just not going to make that connection. And since the rabbis assumed that everything in the Torah is God-given, they felt a great liberty to believe that you could be creative with it, because everything meant something. But I don't know what the limits are. I mean, the limits of Midrash, they try to make certain limits on Midrash. It's hard to do, but effectively in the world, the only limitation in Judaism to Midrash was halakha, was Jewish law. If you made a Midrash that either portrayed people as breaking the law or encouraged people to break the law, that Midrash usually didn't survive. So, yeah. And then I want to get back to why it is that that Abraham didn't tell Isaac not to marry a Canaanite.
This is sort of a footnote, but I've read various sources, and I can't seem to get a fix on it. What is the oldest known copy of the Torah that we have?
The oldest known copy of the entire Torah that we have exists from the 10th century. It's only about 1,000 years old.
Well,
the Dead Sea Scrolls is not the entire Torah.
No, but is that
right.
Our oldest?
Yes. Oh, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest copy of anything that we have are two little copies of the Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, from about 586 BCE, right, yes. But they're just three lines of the Torah, right? I'm saying that's unfortunately all we have. They're little amulets, and they're rolled up in there. They have the priestly blessing. However, the oldest copy, like of an entire book, is Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that's about 2,000 years old. That's from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. And that's what's on exhibit in San Diego, or on the Shrine of the Book if you go to Israel, and that's certainly worth seeing if you've never seen it. I mean, it's supposed to be, and the exhibit is supposed to be a wonderful exhibit. So, yes?
You say a Midrash that speaks of someone greater than the law and history doesn't last. Well, isn't saying that Rebecca had sex with two men to have twins?
Right. That's why it's not accepted. That's why nobody accepts that. Nobody in rabbinic, I want to make clear, nobody in rabbinic tradition says that. They're saying that this is a common mythological motif in Greek mythology and so on, that when people read the Torah, it might occur to them that it's a reinforcement of this whole idea that she was with Eliezer. But it doesn't, the rabbis don't accept it. Right, and don't say, the rabbis never say that Jacob and Esau were from different fathers.
Well, isn't that a Midrash?
No.
It's not?
No. That part is just what they're saying about that it exists in mythological motif, so it might have occurred to people who read the story. But the rabbis themselves, these are scholars at Hebrew University who write today. But the rabbis of the Midrash from 2,000 years ago didn't suggest it. Now, you are pointing to the fact that it's true that sometimes the rabbis suggest very outlandish things, but nobody sort of takes it as mainstream Jewish teaching or practice or so on. Okay, so here's an example of a question and a creative answer. And I bring this up not only because the question's so good, but because the answer is so significant. The Meshech Chochmah, again, asks, why is it that Abraham doesn't say to Isaac, don't marry among the Canaanites? Why does he say it to Eliezer? Okay? And he gives the following answer, right? He says, according to the Talmud, there are three areas where a parent does not have a right to tell their child what to do. Okay? You're not allowed to tell your child they may not study Torah. Parents' authority does not extend to that, okay? You are not allowed to tell your child, actually, by the way, this Talmud Torah gets extended also to what occupation they take. If your child is intent on a certain occupation, as long as it's respectable and honorable, you're not allowed to tell them you can't do that, okay? That's their choice, not your choice. You're not allowed to tell your child they may not make Aliyah to Israel if they wish to make Aliyah to Israel. That's not in a parent's jurisdiction to tell them you can't do that. And you are not allowed to tell your child you may not marry that person if they choose to marry that person. Okay? By the way, now understand that the rabbis always assume that you're governed by Jewish law. Therefore, if the person's not Jewish, the parent isn't telling them, Jewish law is telling them you can't do it. So it doesn't extend to somebody who isn't Jewish, right? They take it for granted that you of course have to tell your child that they can't marry somebody who isn't Jewish, in the same way that you tell your child they can't spend money on Shabbat, right? Breaking the law is breaking the law. But within the confines of the law, you may not tell your child you can't marry that person if that's the person they want to marry and their heart is set on it. Now, remember, at the time, there were no other Jews. So the restriction of you have to marry a Jew didn't apply to Abraham and Isaac. The only restriction that applied was Abraham didn't want him to marry a Canaanite. So he couldn't say to Isaac, you may not marry a Canaanite, because according to the Meshech Chochmah, even though you understand these laws were written 1,000 years after Abraham died, or 1,500 years, but they always use Talmudic law to explain the Bible. So he said, Abraham couldn't say to Isaac, you may not marry a Canaanite, because he wasn't allowed to. You're not allowed to say you can't marry that person. So instead, he told Eliezer, make sure that he doesn't marry a Canaanite. That is a stratagem that every parent knows, right? Sometimes you can't tell your kids things directly, so what do? You work around it, right? You call their friends and say, listen, I just want you to make sure, right, that... And that's why it is that Abraham, according to the Meshech Chochmah, who was a 19th century commentator and scholar, that's why it is that Abraham couldn't tell Isaac. Yes?
But it, up until not so long ago, it was pretty rare that you wanted to go out and find your own.
Yes. Yes, it was pretty rare. In most communities, you had people were... but even there, even when it was a shidduch and you didn't meet your bride until the day of the wedding, even almost under the chuppah, every groom and bride had the right under Jewish law to say, I don't like this person, I don't choose to marry them. Everyone has that right, right? You can't force someone in Jewish law to marry somebody they don't want to marry. That doesn't mean it never happened. But according to Jewish law, everyone retains the right to say that the person is snua, is dislikable to me, so I don't want to marry them.
Don't you think it could have been a psychological ploy too? Because as a parent, you tell your child not to do something, it's only going to make them dig their heels in more, and therefore
them
to come to their own.
Yeah, the answer is yes, sometimes. It depends what it is, you know, but I think, my guess is that really the pshat answer, the simple answer, is the answer that all of us came to, which is that Abraham just wanted to keep Isaac out of it, that this was consistent with Isaac's whole life, which is decisions were made for him more than he made decisions, and Abraham assumed that if he found a suitable candidate, Isaac would be agreeable, and he wanted to go find someone suitable. I don't think that Abraham was constrained by Jewish law in this, but it's a clever answer nonetheless. And it's also an interesting question, which is why doesn't Abraham go directly? Why does he go through this whole, you know, circuitous route to get to, yeah?
Maybe the Torah is trying to teach us that Abraham was not a good parent, because if you give everything for your child, then your child becomes passive, so maybe that's
another... It is a nice drash, and you know, I gave this sermon a while ago about, there was a Psychology Today article about children in college now who are having a very hard time because suddenly they're independent, and they've never been independent. And they have been taken care of to a degree that was unknown in previous generations. So you send a kid to college who literally doesn't know how to do laundry, because they've never ever done laundry. They don't know how to cook anything for themselves, because they've never ever had to do that. And the issue isn't developing the skills, the issue is the feeling of that you have no floor under your feet if you've never ever had to be self-reliant in your entire life. And the parents who think that they're helping their children actually aren't, by preventing them from... If you shield your child from all bad things, then when the day suddenly comes that you're not there to shield them, which happens to all of us, you've left them with no tools to cope with bad things. So it is a problem. And you see it, it's clear, especially in our community, where, as you know, money cushions many, many blows, because it does, there's no question about it, there is a great tendency to try to ensure that children's upbringing will be as easy, as smooth, as stress-free as possible, except, of course, when it comes to getting perfect grades. Yes?
But taking the trash out or giving your kid chores does not take away from having a cushioned life. It builds character.
Well, that's the point of, that's the whole point of the little sermonette, is that in fact, yes, that it's exactly what you're supposed to be doing, is teaching a child how, teaching a child a sense that they actually have to have some responsibility for themselves, because the day will come when they really will. Yes. Well, there are so many, I don't know about you, but there are so many buttons on my dishwasher. I mean, who knows whether, it's not so easy. It's not so easy, right. Yeah.
Just to follow up on that a little bit, my wife works in human resources, and that's what she's finding, is that it's extending way beyond college, and they're finding in the workplace, parents are involved. My wife had a situation
where... And their kids work?
My wife had a situation where a parent called to complain about where a cubicle had been moved. They're called helicopter parents because they're always hovering.
Unbelievable. And wasn't the child ashamed? I mean,
I don't think so. That's a crazy thing.
Yes. Yes.
And then I found a longer version than the one I read. And it talks really about work of the hands. And what you're talking about seems to me to be, it's taking even all these, with the shame and looking at the whole thing, takes away from Rivka, who's not a spoiled child. She goes out, she carries water, she waters camels, she went out there every day to get water, and there's a split between work of the mind and studying and doing things from cooking or anything.
Why does it take away from Rivka? I don't understand.
What I'm saying, what? If you focus more on Rivka and who she was, she was working.
Right. Well, remember...
What I'm saying is that the interpretation, we've been talking about a character in terms of whether she's a virgin or not. And with all due respect, that seems to be an obsession, not from as much from a woman's point of view, but of all the men that were sitting interpreting the Torah.
Well, I would say two things. I'd say two things about this. Yes and no. Yes and no. In the sense that, first of all the men, by the way, who interpreted the Torah, they didn't just sit and interpret. They all had jobs. Right? This is the ancient world. There was no such thing as just sitting and interpreting the Torah. I mean, they were all shepherds, carpenters, all of them had jobs of different kinds. But the idea of a woman's virginity was, it's too easy to say it was a man's obsession. It was a societal obsession. It was an obsession among men and women. And the fact that for the last 50 years, I would say, it has radically changed in some parts of the world shouldn't blind us to the fact that for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, it was tremendously important societally. So what the rabbis are reflecting is, in effect, what everybody in the world, men and women, thought was really important. Now, you can argue that the reason they thought that was important was because men decided it was important. I think that the reason they thought it was important has partly to do with that, but a lot to do with the economics of the world at the time. I mean, it changed when the Industrial Revolution allowed more people into the workforce, and the pill allowed people to have sex without the consequence of pregnancy. And there was more than just all of a sudden women decided, you know, we don't like this. I mean, there are tectonic plates that shift in society. But that's always going to be, in any ancient world, a major source of discussion about a young woman, whether she's a virgin or not a virgin. It's just, one sec, yes.
Structure. So in the early stories, we have these stories of Sarah going off and being with the Pharaoh for a while under his control,
right,
in order to save lives. And we have this story of, it doesn't seem to be a problem that Rivka is going along with Eliezer over on a camel,
right,
not even in a closed car, but anyway, they have fields along the way. So it seems to me that I don't think that sexuality and who sleeps with whom wasn't an issue.
Right.
But I think how it's an issue and how it's defined and how you look at it shifts around what is the importance of it. And we're talking about Rivka's character here and all that sort of thing.
And you see the shift from when, happening from when to when?
I see. Well, I think that it does strike me as interesting that we have all these references. And it's the wrote several books
right.
on this, using archaeological stuff, which is also Raphael Patai's
right.
look at archaeological changes of what happens in biblical times. And she really has a very different interpretation of who Sarah and Rivka might have been and how their sources of connections to Hashem might have been, which is in the Torah. And
well, we actually haven't even talked about that. We haven't talked about that. The purpose of this midrash is not actually to comment, I don't think, on Rivka's character at all. It's just to show you the density of allusion in the way that the tradition looks at the Bible. But there is, which I'm happy, actually I have it upstairs, I'm happy to bring it in. There is a woman's commentary to the Torah that was put out by Ellen Frankel that looks at all of these stories from the point of view of a woman. It has Miriam in the title, though I don't remember. What's that?
I think it's Five Books of Miriam.
Five Books of Miriam. And I would say that it's very, very, very hard, maybe impossible, to figure out shifts of outlook on women in the Torah itself. But between the Torah and the time of the rabbis, you can see it clearly. And there the question is why? Why was the status of women diminished between the Torah and the rabbis? And at least one very popular theory is because the rabbis lived in Rome. And they took from Rome the assumptions about women that Romans had. Although it seems to me it's got to be more complicated than that. Maybe Babylonians too, because they also lived in Babylonia. I don't know what the surrounding, it's hard to know what the surrounding sense is. But it's an interesting question. Yeah.
From a woman's point of view, sex with connection, that whatever you said, and elaborating on my mm-hmm. point of Eliezer making the marriage tolerable for Rivka, that it wasn't whether they had an affair or not, but to have had that connection at the well with Eliezer is maybe what pulled her through. We live with connection. Even sex right. is a tool of connection between two women. And I think the male's perspective is the sexual part, and the woman's is that sense of connection that...
So, look, it's possible. That would be nice if we had a later hint of it. It would make it even more interesting that Rivka had any dealings with Eliezer later. We don't know, but it makes a good midrash. It really does.
So even maybe there was a daughter-father relationship. Maybe
right.
There was, you know, but there was yep. definitely that connection.
Which is often portrayed in stories, right? The older servant who is the confidant of the younger wife who... I'm thinking of... yeah, anyway, so... Yes?
Rabbi, I was thinking that that's why Rivka wanted that Jacob to get the blessing from Isaac, because Jacob is your son.
Right. Well, Jacob, it is possible. Also, remember that, and in fact, this is part of what I'm going to talk about this week, with the question was whether she wanted Jacob to get the blessing because Jacob was Isaac's son and not Esau. Although, I just want you to know that the Torah and the tradition assumes that both Jacob and Esau were Isaac's son. I just want to, you know, there is this mythological motif, but no rabbi that I've ever heard has suggested otherwise. But you do, there is a motif, and I'm going to elaborate on it in the sermon this week, with Jacob and Joseph, that Joseph reminded Jacob of himself. And I think it's fair to say that Jacob reminded Rivka of herself, right? Jacob does grow up to be very much like Rivka, in the sense that, first of all, he's not big, hairy, and hunts, right? He's smooth, and he's very clever, and he manages to get the world arranged sooner or later the way he wants. In that, he's very Rivka-like, so it's not surprising that she favored him. It's a common tendency among parents to favor the child who is most like themselves, right?
So,
what's that?
Yeah.
And she's so like me. Despite the fact that she said to me the other day, "Dad, you know, your jokes are clever, but they're not funny." Yes.
I remember you said something opposite of what you said today. You said another time that Isaac liked Esau because he was unlike himself.
Right. It's exactly. Good point. Right. Well, because I think it's also true. I mean, the problem with psychology is you can explain anything, right? You like the child who's like you, and you're because if the parent feels a big lack in themselves, it's sometimes nice to see that the child has what you lack. It's like, even if I don't have it in me, the fact that I can produce it is a beautiful thing.
So
it could work either way. I think it could work either way. And it's more, I would say, it's true, it's more complicated than, one of the problems with interpreting any text is after the fact, you can always make it fit in, you know? It can fit in. There are so many concepts in something like human psychology that you're always going to be able to. But the test is, does it ring true? Does it, you know, and is it suggestive? That is, I mean, all the stuff that we've just spent, look, we just spent an hour on stories about Rivka that none of us actually believe, right? It doesn't fit with what she is. It doesn't fit with the tradition. It doesn't fit with the rest of the Bible. But there's enough of a hint that it's interesting to look at. And that's part of what makes the Torah so rich, is even the things that you don't believe, the Torah teaches you something about the way people work. I mean, look at this. Look how much you've gotten out of the idea, for example, that that Rivka has her own connection to people and to God, and that she's not subordinate in the story, and all of that comes out of stuff that we don't even believe about her. So, yeah. Yeah.
In this modern day TV, you think like, my God, like, well, this doesn't like happening, and you turn it off, but it's like not that different.
Well, Amos Oz was here, and he spoke, and he said, as a writer, if I were given a choice to go to the moon or to be a fly on the wall of any family, I would take the family. And if you have not read his book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, about growing up in Jerusalem, before the State of Israel was founded, it's funny, it's fascinating, it's incredibly observant about the way families look. I'll give you, I'll tell you a word about it. I rarely recommend books this certainly, but you can't read this and not love it. You can't. His mother committed suicide, and he and his father never spoke about it. They never spoke about it. And this whole book is in part an attempt to understand his mother and who she was and who his father was. And it's an amazing book. It's called A Tale of Love and Darkness. And at the same time, the author is Amos Oz, O-Z. Amos Oz. And at the same time, it's at any bookstore, or you can get it on Amazon or anywhere. It actually sold very well, and it won all sorts of awards, including he won an award in Germany for it, and he won an award in Israel, and it was nominated here for something, I don't remember what. And it also will give you a picture of what that world was like that is amazing. I'll give you one quick story from the book, and then we can call it a day. I don't remember who it was. I think it was his uncle. He had just been given a 5-pound note or a 10-pound note, a 10 shekel note, or it was an old shekelim then, and probably liras. And it had a picture of Ben-Gurion on it. And his uncle took a look at it and grabbed it from him. And this was his like Hanukkah gift or something. And he said, how can you take that? And his uncle said, Ben-Gurion once borrowed 10 pounds from me. Right? So, but that's the world he lived in. I mean, all the famous scholars and teachers and so on, his original name is not Oz, it's Klausner. And his uncle, Joseph Klausner, was one of the most important scholars of early Israel. And he and Agnon had a long-running feud, Agnon being the most important writer of early Israel. And it's just fascinating to hear the rivalries, and even if you've never heard of any of the characters, it's a wonderful book, and he's a fabulous writer. So if from this you go on to some of his novels, that would be good. Yeah.
Child and it's constantly being forced into an adult, You don't question.
Right.
You don't even go in and study.
Yes.
For yourself.
Yeah.
You say, well, I've heard this child, a child, so it must be true. Also, you said that a parent is not supposed to tell a child who to marry.
No, I said, I didn't say that a parent can't tell a child who to marry. I said that according to Jewish law, a parent can't prevent the child from marrying someone they love.
Oh, okay.
Right, which is different. You can say, I really think you should marry this person. But if the child says, no, I don't love that person, I love that person, as long as the person is Jewish, according to Jewish law, The child wins, basically. A parent may not outlaw, because in many things, a parent can actually say no. You're not allowed to do that. But that part of what this class is supposed to be about is questioning stories that we have long known and making them different. Next week, Reuven Firestone, please tell people, and I'll see you then. Thanks.